Why don't you work like other folks do? How in hell can I work when there's no work to do? Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Well, I went to a bar and I asked for a drink. Man gave me a glass and he showed me the sink. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout and revive us again. Well, I knocked on a door and I asked for some bread. The lady said, scram bum, the baker is dead. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Well, why don't you save all the money you earn? If I did not eat, I'd have money to burn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Oh, I like my boss. He's a good friend of mine. That's why I'm starving out in the bread line. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Whenever I get all the money I earn, the boss will be broke and to work he must turn. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. And why do you work for 8 hours or more? There'd be jobs for us both if you'd only work four. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. Why speed up like that till you're ready to fall? If you slow down a bit, there'd be work for us all. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. If you can't find a job and they won't give you bread, give a kind-hearted copper to be on your head. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again. But don't you complain and don't open your eyes. Don't talk revolution and don't organize. Hallelujah, I'm a bum. Hallelujah, bum again. Hallelujah, give us a handout to revive us again.
Hi, it's Lynn from IWW with the WOB Radio Show, all about labor news and labor happenings, labor history. And so we hope you like it. We hope you listen. We hope you listen every week, every month that you can. So anyway, I pass it to Alan.
Hey, guys. Hello, gals. And howdy to all my non-binary friends and pals. Alan, been a member for a long time and don't do much anymore. I'm retired and I've got a bad back, so I just like to listen to people talk.
Hello, fellow workers and listeners. I'm fellow worker Gordon. I live in Bremerton, but I'm a member of the Tacoma branch of the IWW. I prefer he, him pronouns. I've been a Wobbly since, on and off since about 2008, and currently a member and part of WOB Radio.
My name is fellow worker Noah. I've been in the Tacoma IWW since March of 2021. I am also a delegate and I've been a longtime contributor to WOB Radio since I joined. I also do the editing side of things as well. I've really enjoyed my time here in the IWW, being able to do a lot of the journalism work that I previously enjoyed when I was in college. And I think that this show has really meant a lot to me in terms of contributing to working class related news.
Hello, listeners. My name is Marilyn. I go by she, they. I've been a member of the IWW since about 2008. I am a retired mental health worker in the community mental health care system. And I am a delegate. So if you decide that you would like to join the IWW, which is Industrial Workers of the World, and you're and of course you're listening to WOB Radio. WOB stands for Wobblies. You can contact via email the Chicago branch, the general membership, and if you tell them your address, then they will connect us, and I can induct you into the IWW if that's something you want to do.
We might want to point out that a delegate in our union is sort of the equivalent of a shop steward in an AFL-CIO union. We just we've had our system going for a long time, and we prefer to call our representatives delegates.
Thank you. So I will go ahead and read off a section of the preamble to the Constitution of the IWW, and the preamble is basically a summary of our mission statement and our values. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. These conditions can be changed, and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old. Big shout out to the Whatcom Skagit branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, because this is happening right in your backyard. There is currently 1,100 operational student employees at Western Washington University filing for a union. This article comes from thestand.org, news about working people standing together in Washington State. This following is from WAWU, WAWU/UAW. Western Washington University's 1,100 operational student employees filed to form a union Wednesday with majority support at the Washington State Public Employment Relations Commission, the PERC. They also delivered a letter to Western administration requesting recognition of their union, the Western Academic Workers United, at UAW. So that's why the acronym is the way that it is. It's WAWU-UAW. They will be the first organized student employees in Washington State doing work other than academic work. Operational student employees includes program support staff, recreation assistants, clerks, laborers, lifeguards, resident advisors, assistants, attendees, publication editors, and more. They include hundreds of undergraduate students from every program. OSCs perform critical work, including managing events, providing support services, doing outdoor recreation, and recreation work. However, OSCs cite ongoing struggles around low and late pay, unsafe work environments, unpredictable schedules, and the need for a voice at work to determine their working conditions as reasons for forming a union. So this is basically out of Bellingham, Washington. My brother actually used to go to Western for a few years back when I was still in high school. I've been around that campus quite a bit. And I'm personally kind of surprised that, you know, there's 1,100 student employees at one university all organizing at the same time. I think that that's a pretty cool example of, like, mass worker power, especially within a non-academic setting at a school.
You know, the only thing, as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, what a shame that the assistant professors aren't part of this same union. Because then it truly would be an industrial union.
Absolutely. And I can imagine, and maybe I'm just pulling this out of my rear, but I could also imagine that teaching assistants and teachers might be organized with a different union at this particular college. I don't have the details on that from this article in specific. But yeah, it would be cool if the non-academic student workers could link up with academic student workers, teaching assistants, and teachers.
There's like more strength that way.
Yeah.
Are those called adjunct? Professors.
Yeah. Adjunct professors, yeah. Typically, and this is just from what I understand, adjunct professors or teachers can be unionized along with full-time teachers or staff there as well. To finish off this article here, OSEs will join 1,100 educational student employees, or ESEs, tutors, teaching assistants, research assistants, and others who do research and instructional work at Western, who filed to form a union 1 year ago and are currently bargaining a first contract. With this filing by OSEs, there will be wall-to-wall representation of all student workers at Western. Some workers might be an OSC 1 year and an ESC the other, or even both at the same time. ESCs and OSEs have been working together in this effort to improve working conditions at Western and higher education on the whole. So this, like you said, this does sound like a kind of a joint movement between tutors, teaching assistants, research assistants, and non-academic student workers.
Well, except that there's a separation, and it sounds like they bargain separately.
Right.
And that's what I was looking for, because what I'm seeing happening in the United States more is industrial unionization. That's starting to happen, like with the railroad workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've always got my eye out for when I see something like that happening. So what? Good for them for what they're doing, and hopefully at some point in the future they'll decide to all unionize together.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the educational student employees, like you said, they filed a year ago and are still organizing their first contract.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, these workers, the operational
right,
student
I got
employees,
that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it would have been cool if they all could have organized at the same time.
It can happen in the future.
Fair. I imagine that the ESEs might be organizing with a different union as well, because the OSEs are organizing with the UAW, but this article doesn't seem to cite who the ESEs are organizing with. It might be another teachers-related union.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Of course. Our next piece of labor news here also comes out of Washington State, but this time it's coming out of Olympia. So this is from Northwest Labor Press. This is another news outlet that we get a lot of our labor news from, especially here in the Pacific Northwest region. There is currently a bill which would give strikers in Washington the right to unemployment benefits. Now, this was posted on December 15th, 2023, so this is just about a half month ago that this was announced. But the Washington State Legislature will consider a bill next year that would make strikers eligible for unemployment benefits. Senate Bill 5777, filed December 4th, is sponsored by Washington State Senator Karen Kaiser of Des Moines, and has 15 co-sponsors. As reported by the Washington State Standard, a nonprofit news organization, the bill would make striking workers eligible to receive unemployment assistance beginning the second week after walking off the job. The 2024 legislation of the Washington State Legislature begins on January 8th. That's 2 days after we make this radio recording. And I think that this is pretty exciting, because normally when workers go on strike, they can receive, say, a strike fund through their union, or if they're just laid off from the job and they're currently in between different workplaces, unions can provide unemployment benefits as well. But specifically for striking workers, they're kind of left to relying on a strike fund, which, depending on your union, is either quite a bit of money, like the United Mine Workers or the UAW, or it might be a much smaller union that doesn't have as much in the bank. So I think that this is a pretty cool piece of pro-worker legislation that's going to be coming up here in a couple of days.
If it gets through.
If it gets through. I know that we live in a quote-unquote blue state, and, you know, a lot of the Democratic Party is, on paper, very supportive of labor rights. With the memory of the railroad workers in the back of my head, I really don't know how exactly this is going to play out.
No, we don't.
I really doubt that it'll pass.
What makes you think it won't?
Because supposedly when you get unemployment, it's because it's no fault of your own. If it's something that you cause, like you quit, you're not eligible. And so they might consider this the same way, that you've voluntarily mm-hmm. or the group has elected to do this. So, I mean, it'll be really interesting, but I just really wonder whether it could pass.
If it
legally.
Does pass, what the indication is not only do workers have rights to strike, but that their right is so strong because of unfair labor practices or whatever with the employer, that they are entitled to some kind of compensation. So it would be a huge, strong statement, and it would really indicate a recognition of worker rights that we have not yet seen.
And it might even potentially redefine unemployment law as well, because like Lynn said, going on strike is technically acting of your own accord to cease work, and normally unemployment is given to people who are essentially unemployed for reasons out of their control, whether they're laid off, whether it's a seasonal position, things like that. So I guess a weird roundabout effect of this bill, if it does pass, is that it would potentially redefine unemployment law as well. Yes?
The other side of going on strike is an employer lockout. And I would think that it would make very much good sense, because in that situation, it's not the employee's fault.
Mm-hmm.
It's the employer wanting to make a point about organizing, and so they lock the employees out. It's no fault of their own. They didn't volunteer for that.
Right.
Do we know who introduced this bill?
This bill was introduced it was initially sponsored by Washington State Senator Karen Kaiser of Des Moines, and has 15 co-sponsors. Since the Washington State Legislature doesn't open until the 8th, there's going to be no immediate action on this yet. Of course, I imagine there are probably other bills that have already been filed and are probably waiting to be deliberated. But yeah, this is coming up pretty soon, and I think it'll be pretty interesting to follow along with. Another piece out of Northwest Labor Press, a judge ordered Starbucks to rehire fired baristas. This is also from December 15th. In their combined 34 years at Starbucks, Heather Clark and Gail Kleeman had just two disciplinary write-ups between the two of them, until they told managers that they wanted a union. Within 10 months of signing cards to join Starbucks Workers United, both were fired, allegedly for violating Starbucks policies. On November 27th, a federal administrative law judge found that the coffee giant's real reason for firing them was their support of the union, and ruled the firing illegal. Judge Sharon Levinson Steckler ordered Starbucks to give Clark and Kleeman their jobs back and pay them any wages and benefits they lost. It's the first Oregon case where an NLRB judge has reinstated pro-union baristas, but it won't be the last. Since the first baristas organized 2 years ago in Buffalo, New York, Starbucks has been accused of unfair labor practices in 698 separate cases, including 41 in Oregon. The NLRB has reviewed and sided with workers on about 400 of those cases so far, and judges have ordered Starbucks to reinstate 36 workers at stores across the nation. Starbucks has appealed most of these decisions, but the NLRB rulings against Starbucks have been overturned. So this is kind of part of a larger article here that's basically written about how Starbucks's strategies to retaliate against organized workers. And then they fire them, and then the NLRB has essentially been saying, no, you fired them for siding with the union, not because of any actual workplace violations. Or if there were workplace violations, they were extremely minuscule. Managers, of course, will find a lot of reasons to lay off employees in situations like this. The sheer number of claims against Starbucks, the NLRB has been consolidating multiple complaints to speed things up. Clark and Kleeman's ULP charges were combined with other complaints about managers at Johnson Creek Crossing, that they had prohibited union t-shirts and taken down union strong flyers in the store. The NLRB judge heard the consolidated case in August. Workers United lawyers say that it's one of the quicker turnarounds for a case like this. Yeah, so the Starbucks unionization campaign is still going on pretty strong. It sounds like they've been facing, the company Starbucks has been facing a lot of legal pressure and a lot of legal consequences for their union busting as well. At the current moment, from what I've seen, gleaning around other Starbucks Workers United related articles, it doesn't sound like Starbucks has even yet to sit down with any of their organized workplaces. And it's been well over 2 years since this campaign began. And it's kind of surprising that the NLRB is taking its time to get around on that. But at the very least, Starbucks Workers United workers are getting back their jobs after being illegally fired. So that's a pretty positive update.
It should be pointed out that ULP stands for an unfair labor practice. And it's not necessarily what, if the listeners are unfamiliar with labor law, unfair labor practice usually means that the employer is illegally interfering with a union officer from doing their job. So that's a ULP. And it's not really recommended because to go on strike for ULP, because it's an arduous and long process, but it is illegal. It is a legal reason to go out on strike.
So there is an update out of the UAW. There was supposed to be a strike of about 1,500 workers at a Allison Transmission Holdings Incorporated, essentially a parts company for automotive vehicles. And the United Auto Workers just announced that they have reached a tentative agreement as of last night with the auto parts maker, covering those 1,500 workers in Indianapolis. The four-year contract guarantees a starting wage of $20 an hour for UAW employees and retroactive pay hikes until November 15th of last year, and two categories of bonus that amount to $7,000, the union said. All bargaining unit employees with more than 4 years of seniority will immediately receive traditional pay, with a general wage increase on top of that, the UAW said, a reference to what it said was the Schedule D top rate. The agreement has been endorsed by the International UAW and the local 933 leadership and is subject to ratification by union members. So there's an agreement on the table. It has yet to be ratified by the union members out at Allison Transmission. But I think it's pretty surprising how quickly the UAW said that these workers were getting ready to go on strike. And within a matter of 2 or 3 days, as of last night, they finally reached an agreement. So I think it really kind of stands to the amount of organizing and the amount of power that their previous strikes have had over other automotive makers and the automotive industry as a whole, that these employers are willing to organize and settle with the potential strikes really quickly for the agreements that the UAW and the workers are putting forward. So that's pretty cool.
Well, I'd like to make some comments on that. Do we know the name of the president of the United Auto Workers right now?
Sean Fain.
Okay. And the name of the guy before him?
I'm not familiar.
We don't remember him, do we? Do we know where he is?
Familiar.
He's in prison. The way that UAW used to, it's all better now, I'm sure. Rather than have all three of those auto companies negotiate with one union at the same time, more or less, they take turns. This contract will be Ford, next contract will be GM. When the third big three was Fiat Chrysler, Daimler Benz, whoever it was, they sent one of their employees, an Italian guy, who's also in prison. Why? But the guy, the UAW guy who's in prison now, he got a package of money, which was shared around with his comrades to make sure that the automobile manufacturers were satisfied with the contract. That was decided before negotiations started. You can look this all up online if you go to the Detroit Free Press.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere there's also some footage when the FBI raided this guy's house. There was a helicopter outside. He did the perp walk and they found a safe full of tons of money. That's a corrupt outfit. And the new guy is supposed to be a reform guy, but he didn't actually get elected. He did that by acclamation. He went to the convention and they all applauded. He's now the new union boss.
Why? So, doesn't that go against the bylaws?
It goes against the Bible, for all I know. They don't know. The bylaws don't apply to these guys. That's why the current guy, who's head of the UAW, one of his opponents, who was a socialist, of course didn't win. So he's now gone to the feds and complaining of union interference in the election.
Hmm.
He didn't think he got a fair deal. So we'll see if that works out. But it gets pretty deep over there. I mean, I'll just do this and I'll stop. I began paying attention to this when I noticed there's an article about once a year, the United Auto Workers from Detroit, and in the wintertime, it's cold and snowy, right? They go to California. There's a very nice gated community with bungalows where the top union bosses get to go for golf and dinner, and I guess they go to meetings too, for a while. And then they send the rest of the troops back to the snow in Detroit, and they stayed.
Hmm.
And they stayed. And they stayed. People get to wonder, where the hell are these guys? They're playing golf, drinking whiskey, smoking cigars, buying those funny pants that golfers wear. But that could be hearsay.
I think it is very interesting to notice, especially with these bigger trade unions, you know, there has been this kind of push to be like, okay, we have to more honestly represent the will of the workers. We have to more honestly represent their needs and desires for their union contracts and stuff like that. And obviously they've been doing kind of a decent job at the whole anti-corruption campaign, especially with the UAW and more further to the past, the Teamsters and things like that. I think that there has been a lot of well-minded people stepping up to union leadership in some of these positions. I really have a lot of hope in Sean Fain because he kind of seems to have this, maybe not hardcore radical, but he definitely has this very pro-worker stance, and he really does a good job elaborating on that whenever he does speeches or is out on the picket line and things like that. But I still think that they, like you said, they still have a ways to go in terms of things like industrial organizing or in terms of, you know, making sure that their union funds are used appropriately, making sure that the people that are getting paid in the union are being kept tabs upon. I have faith in Sean Fain. I think the UAW has cleaned up its image as well as its ability to organize pretty well. But yeah, it sounds like they definitely have a couple more skeletons under the rug that they need to deal with.
We discussed on the last broadcast, tiered workplaces, tiered wage scales, mm-hmm. and how outrageous and unjust it is, because I am a senior worker, so I'm on a different wage schedule, and then across the assembly line from me is a newer employee, and she's not getting the same wage that I'm getting because she's on a different tier. And what Sean Fain and his outfit want to do is eliminate all those tiered wage schedules.
Right. That's the kind of the current situation out of the UAW at the moment. The last news article that we have to talk about before we get into the book review, because I'm really looking forward to this book review. And now to close out very briefly our local and labor news section. As many of us have been following the Manuel Ellis case here in Tacoma, Washington, the three officers who were initially investigated for his death, some would say his murder, but his death, were acquitted by a court late last month, and there has been a huge outpouring of anger and support for the Ellis family since then. I'm not sure if there will be any further charges put against these officers. I believe that the Ellis family has also...
Sorry.
It's okay. I believe that the Ellis family has also tried to sue the city of Tacoma, but that has been the recent update in regards to the Manuel Ellis case. And I've been following this case since it became public right around the time of the George Floyd protests in 2020. And in many ways, in some ways, it's a lot like our own local police brutality, George Floyd-related incident. It didn't go as nationally viral as George Floyd's murder did. But unfortunately, those three officers have been let off, and there doesn't seem to be any consequences for their part in all of this. So... that's a very unfortunate update in terms of local news. Anyways, in regards to the jury aspect of the trial, this was a public jury trial. A lot of the discussion during the past few months as the court case went along, specifically the court case attempting to try and convict these three officers who killed Manuel Ellis, the jury did not have the same access to information that the public did regarding the officers' work histories, their training history. I remember reading back, and I believe it was the News Tribune, that one of the officers had performed pretty poorly during his training. Like, they use simulators for shoot or don't shoot situations in a lot of police academies. And apparently he had failed that exercise, I believe, a couple of times. He shot the wrong person in a simulation.
He won the Dirty Harry Award for...
Yeah, and despite that, the Tacoma Police Department was willing to overlook it and hire him on anyhow.
Well, and the other issue was that a lot of the evidence, the judge wouldn't allow to be presented. Mm-hmm. And also, the trial turned into much more of a trial of Manny Ellis than it did of the police officers.
Yeah. Yes.
What's currently happening is a lot of people are calling on the city of Tacoma to at least fire those three police officers, because that is within their purview.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And always was.
They did the same thing with Trayvon. They did the same thing with Mike Brown.
Yeah.
And the cop union would defend them too.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
To the hilt. It's the he's no angel mm-hmm. defense.
Yeah. And it's not about that at all.
Correct.
The official reasoning that the court gave that Manuel Ellis's passing was a death and not a murder is the quote-unquote excited delirium mm-hmm. that he was under when he was under duress by being detained by the three officers.
It's so a made-up thing.
You know, if I were being kept from getting oxygen, mm-hmm. I would be excitedly delirious too.
Exactly. Now, the initial autopsy, and I know the family ordered a second autopsy, the initial autopsy did say that he did have some substances in his system, and there's been a lot of arguments back and forth as to whether or not that would have caused excited delirium that caused him to pass away, therefore it wasn't a murder, is kind of the defense's case for these officers.
Well, I'm afraid it's another case of same old, same old, same old.
And, you know, I watched I've mentioned Philosophy Tube on this radio show before. It's one of the YouTube channels I follow. She did a video talking about the law and the police and the philosophy behind it, but she was talking specifically about English law enforcement, and there was this very big book published by a longtime police officer talking about what's wrong within policing, how it could possibly be fixed. It wasn't exactly a abolitionist argument, but was very much a I've been on the inside and I know the problems within the English policing system kind of perspective. But this author that Philosophy Tube was talking about specifically mentioned sudden death in restraint syndrome,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't really go into detail about the background of this supposed diagnosis when some people get detained by the police. The police and some medical communities have given ideas that, you know, putting someone in a high-stress situation and then suddenly calming them down and forcing them to be in one place all at once can cause cardiac-related issues, but it's a very vague diagnosis for people dying in police custody, and it really raises suspicion. And I can't help but find a bit of an overlap with that and the Manny Ellis case, this sudden death in restraint syndrome versus excited delirium excuse.
Yeah, that would make their heart race and stuff like that, being confined to an uncomfortable position and knowing that you might be killed.
Exactly.
Because of the climate and the history.
Yeah, so this is a very grim update out of the city of Tacoma, and hopefully the campaign to fire those officers continues to go forward. As far as I'm aware, they're now back on the force and out of semi-retirement during the time
of
the trial.
Well, they're getting their full pay.
Mm-hmm.
They were all along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is a very unfortunate case, and I lend all of my thoughts and support to the Ellis family during this time.
Hello, fellow workers and listeners out there in Radio Land. It's time for our segment. My name is fellow worker Gordon, and I'm going to give a book review on a book I've reread, and it's called Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. And it's written by Adam Hochschild, a guy who's very prolific. He's a historian, but he writes in an extremely accessible style. If you've heard my other book reviews, you'll know that I'm a big fan of that kind of style that allows common people, regular people, regular readers, to experience and access, you know, a pretty thorough history without getting bogged down in academic detail. And so Adam Hochschild does a really fine job of that. So the book is about the conflict that was in Spain in the mid-1930s. And the author does a really fine job of setting the scene in Europe and in the United States, because it's about Americans that went over to Spain to fight for the Spanish Republic. And here, I don't want to confuse the listeners, but usually I don't use the word Republican in a benign sense. But this time, the good guys are the Republicans, and the bad guys are the Nationalists. And you'll find out why. So in Europe, in the 1930s, naturally, the whole Western world, really the whole world, was undergoing the Great Depression, which began with the stock market crash in 1929 in New York City. And it just there were no safety nets back then. There was no Security and Exchanges Commission. A lot of gambling and speculating went on Wall Street, sort of like it is today. And that's why, instead of my typical fallback, which is I like to talk about the IWW in history and how, you know, the IWW got affected and affected others back in their time. So I'm straying a little bit from that theme, because it's very important to know that what happened in Spain in 1936 is happening now in the United States of America. And you might not think it's possible for a military to stage a coup.
Oh, no, we believe.
Yeah, it's not only possible, but it could definitely happen. So anyway, the parallels between Spain in the mid-1930s and our current situation in the world today is very close. That's why I think the book is worthy of reading. So the book is published, in case you want to find out where to get it. It's Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and 2016 was the date of its release. You can probably find it in a number of book outlets, like perhaps PM, AK Press, Jacobin, the people who put out the Jacobin magazine. They probably have a line on that. I forgot where I bought it, but I got it online, and I got an autographed copy.
And the name again?
The name is Spain in Our Hearts.
Thank you.
Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939.
That's right. And so by setting the scene, which Hochschild does really well, he paints a picture of what Europe was like. You're in the middle of a Great Depression. Okay, a lot of unemployment, a lot of trouble. As we know, the Nazis came to power in 1933 in Germany. The fascists had already been in power since the 1920s in Italy, Benito Mussolini's merry band. And that's a pretty desperate and totalitarian political philosophy. Unfortunately, it worked when it first was promoted. And everybody got a job. You know, everybody, the trains ran on time. So on the surface, fascism can look pretty attractive, especially if you're a low information type person and you don't know what's going on with those guys. So he is drawing a parallel between the fascism of that time. I'm drawing the parallel, actually. He's just giving us news reports about what was going on.
So, I would like to interject really quickly.
Sure.
A lot of the big appeal of fascism back in the time was that prospect of economic recovery.
Right.
And the Nazis and the Italian fascists really put on this show of, like you said, you know, in Italy, there's that famous phrase, well, the trains will run on time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in Nazi Germany, a lot of people attributed fascism's success to its so-called economic miracle. But just like today, that so-called economic rebound was basically towards the big capitalists that backed the Nazi Party, that backed the Italian fascists.
Right.
A lot of workers' wages were frozen at pre-Depression rates. A lot of that wealth was later confiscated by the people that the Nazis were persecuting, and of course the war campaign later on in the 40s. So there was this brief appearance of an economic miracle that got it a lot of support, but in reality it was just freezing everything in place, setting up fiat currencies that would fail, and freezing wages for most of the working class while the business class got all the goods.
That's a good observation. Also, at the same time in Europe, we also had moribund empires. We had the Spanish Empire, which still existed. They had a colony in North Africa, Spanish Morocco. They had some other possessions overseas. It wasn't, you know, the Spanish Main. It wasn't like when Columbus was working for the outfit, but they still had empires. They still had monarchies that were more or less successful. And they had feudalism. They had a very feudal system, especially in the Iberian Peninsula, which is Spain and Portugal. They had some really bad, 25%. At least 25% illiteracy rate. I mean, peasants who could not read and write their own language, and so easily controlled, and you know, people chafing at oppression. So the political ferment was very strong. They were having street fights in Germany between communists and fascists, and same thing in Italy. So it was not a peaceful situation. So the author goes on. He uses a good device. He follows the history of the Spanish Civil War. That's pretty much the only time I see Civil War is on the cover. He doesn't say use the term Civil War. He's explaining the action and reaction. But he explains that he uses the device of following a couple of married couples and a reporter and that comes over to Spain. And he gives brief biographical sketches of them. You know, they're interesting people. Most of them were middle class and progressive. The reporter was a working class guy, but you know, he was a reporter, relatively privileged. So he uses this device, and he introduces us to Bob Merriman and his wife Marion, and they met at the University of Nevada. So this is back in the 20s and early 30s. So University of Nevada was not exactly a hub of learning at that time. It probably is now, UNLV, you know. But back then, it was pretty much a country college. And so he meets his wife, and he eventually wins a position at Berkeley for graduate work, and he studies economics. This is Berkeley, 1930s. Okay. So he is being influenced by Marxist economics. And so let's see. At the same time, in the San Francisco Bay Area, they had a general strike And that was something I didn't know too much about. I had heard about the longshore guys going on strike in 34. But this was a general strike. And the only other time that happened was right up here in Seattle and Tacoma in 1919, where they paralyzed. They paralyzed the industry around Puget Sound and pretty much won a lot of their demands, not all of them. So I mentioned that they're street fighting. Over in Asia, Japan had already annexed the nation of Korea, right? They annexed it in 1910. And also they invaded Manchuria, a big chunk of China. And they were setting up their own empire, the East Asia Code Prosperity Sphere, or whatever it was. So Louis Fisher was that journalist, and he had a background in, left politics. But also, Hochschild was stressing the technology of the day. We have the internet. Back then, radio was still new. We had telegraph services that still worked all over the world. We had wire photo technology, where you could send a picture, black and white picture, over the wire, anywhere on the planet that had a receiver. So this was kind of like very important technological advances and instantaneous, near instantaneous communication, not like today. But Fisher went to Moscow because everybody was drawn, if you were a progressive in the United States, you were drawn to the successful workers' revolution in Russia. And people were very idealistic about it.
Beg your pardon, I don't mean to interrupt you, but the successful revolution?
Well,
what?
Okay, well, they
start over again.
Well, they overthrew the Tsar, you know, but that doesn't necessarily make it a people's revolution, right? And we had guys like Stalin, good old Uncle Joe, who was anything but a socialist, in my opinion. As a matter of fact, Fisher meets him, falls under the guy's spell. He says he was a charming, simple soldier. Yeah, Joseph Stalin. Now, Spanish politics came out, and they elected a progressive government. And they immediately began to be isolated. And, of course, there was a struggle in the Soviet Union between Stalin and Trotsky. Definitely not a united front. So the only country to offer any support to the Spanish Republic, the Republicans, who were being going to have coup made against them by Francisco Franco and his fascist army, most of them colonials, either Foreign Legion or Moorish soldiers, they called them. In other words, Africans who got drafted into the Spanish army and used as shock troops. So the only country to do anything was, believe it or not, at first was Mexico. And Mexico sent 20,000 rifles to them, which were definitely needed. But no artillery pieces, no tanks, no airplanes. That's what the Soviet Union began doing. So they began to align with the Soviet Union in these Republican zones. In many of the Republican zones, especially in Catalonia and in the Basque country on the north coast of Spain, they were run like anarcho-syndicalist collectives. Five-star hotels were turned into people's cafeterias. Buses were running for free. The bus drivers would not accept the fare. There was the People's Revolution. And in Catalonia and in Basque country, they also had an advantage that they had their own language, and customs. Yes, they're part of Spain politically, but the Catalan language is not Spanish and it's not French. It's sort of a melding. And the Basque language, nobody knows where they came from. So the stage has been set here for what's going to turn into a real bloodbath. The factions in Spain was the CNT-AIT, that is the Confederación Nacional de Trabajo and Federación Anarquista Ibérica, and their colors were red and black. That's our colors too. And there was another faction called POUM. That's the one that George Orwell ended up being a soldier in. These were non-Stalinist Marxists or independent Marxists. And he had the Communist Party of Spain, which was run by the Comintern in Moscow. So we had all these internal contradictions, guess what, amongst the anarchists, right? They had different interpretations of anarchist theory and practice. I like the syndicalist version, but there are other versions of anarchism. And they were kind of squabbling amongst themselves. So,
as anarchists always do.
Yeah.
And during a civil war, no doubt.
Well, yeah. It hadn't. See, that's the thing about the book. he's setting the stage and you're getting all this nice background information and, you know, you're going over to Spain and then suddenly they're in the thick of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're in the fighting. And these are guys like college kids and out of work, you know, iron workers and things like that. And so,
or romantics.
Well, yes, there was an element of mm-hmm. romance, and that is also a parallel to today. Recently in Syria and in Iraq, the Kurdish zones, Rojava, they set up similar anarcho-syndicalist type movements. Have women in leadership positions, women in combat units, and that's what they were doing over in Spain.
Yeah.
So this is way ahead of its time. And then he also draws a portrait of Franco. And this is one sorry son of a gun. This Franco was a... also the Roman Catholic Church in Spain was allied with the nationalists. Mm-hmm. They liked the old traditional stuff. They didn't like Marxism. They didn't like any of this newfangled freedom.
They greatly also contributed to and defended the very stratified structure of Spanish society.
Indeed.
The class system was a lot more strict at that time.
Even stricter than England's.
Yeah.
And, you know, and with all the moralisms that go along with a fascist society. And so I drew a parallel between Gaza and Ukraine today.
Oh, good. I'm going to hear it.
And, people would listen. This was the Spanish Civil War was one of those things where people would gather around newsstands, gather around a radio, right? No TV. And listen to the dispatches from the front. And we're getting a similar information filtered, of course, through corporate media. But we can strain out some of the facts, right? So people were following that worldwide, people who were interested in that, and just like they're following Gaza and Ukraine today.
And Syria
and other parts of the Mideast. So what happened was that Madrid, which was part of the Republican zone, came under attack by the fascists. And it was one of these house-to-house, even floor-to-floor in a big office building, fighting. Imagine pitching hand grenades at each other inside an office building. But anyway, Madrid was basically under siege, and that's when the international brigades got formed. And I remember as a boy going with my friend's parents to a May Day parade in New York, and I remember seeing this whole squad of old guys, I mean, white-haired men, marching down the street with a banner, and I said, "Who are those guys?" And it was almost like a holy procession was passing us. It's the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. You know, like, take your hat off. And so the international brigades formed all over the world. And it was unique because it was a political movement. They wanted to defend freedom in Spain, somebody else's country. And they volunteered to go fight. So the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was the one from the United States. And it had a mixture of people. Most of them were communists or communist youth. But there were some revolutionary socialists and just plain old liberal progressives who got angry enough to go over there and fight for democracy. So basically the book goes from there into a pretty detailed account of the war itself, the equipment that they had, the training, the battles, and that is the historical part of the book that history buffs and military history buffs will find fascinating. I'd like to get into it, but it's too detailed.
Gordon, I have a question.
Sure.
So does this book talk a little bit about what happens at the end of the war? Does it talk at all about the rise of cooperatives?
No, not very much. It talks about some of the economic activity in the Republican zones and how they organized, how they collectivized. Also, a shout out, if you're interested in watching a movie instead of reading a book, go see Ken Loach's Land and Freedom. Mm-hmm. It's an excellent, excellent movie. It's entertaining on top of being factually accurate.
Is that an old movie?
I think it's about 20 years old by now.
I think it's from the 90s.
Yeah.
We should get a hold of it and show it at King's Books or something.
That we should. We definitely should. Land and Freedom.
I also wanted to chip into this conversation, too, because I also kind of read through this book in the upcoming couple of weeks. Not all the way through, but just a couple of interesting notes. I really like that you drew the parallel between the international volunteers, specifically the international brigades, which is organized by communist and socialist parties. There were a bunch of independent volunteers who later went over to the CNT-FAI, or the P-U-O-M, like George Orwell. There's a lot of kind of
Ernest
similar...
Ernest Hemingway was there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mainly as a reporter, but he was there on the front lines as well.
He did ambulance driving, too.
Yeah. It's very interesting to notice, because when I noticed the Syrian civil war start to kick off back in the early 2010s, I remember hearing about Rojava and the expanding revolution that was taking place in northern Syria and Iraq, where there's this majority group of ethnic peoples that are Kurdish, and they organize their own system of self-governance and organization called democratic confederalism. And it's still going on today. They still have a huge swath of area. But I was following the news reports of, you know, people that were my age, college kids, just like the college kids that went off to go fight in Spain, go and volunteer for the People's Defense Forces, I believe that's what they were called, in Rojava, and the Women's Forces as well. And it
PKP,
was
that's
how I initially heard about the Spanish Civil War, was because people were drawing the parallels.
Right.
The funny thing about the Soviet support, though, people who know me personally know, I'm a slight bit of a gun buff. Not crazy, but a slight bit of a gun buff.
You're crazy.
A lot of the support that the Soviet Union sent the Spanish Republicans through the Comintern and stuff like that wasn't exactly their top-of-the-line stuff. A lot of the stuff people were getting on the front lines were, like, black powder rifles from the time that, from the beginning of the First World War, or from the conflict between what was then Tsarist Russia and Turkey. There was a shipment, I remember reading in the book, of some, I think it was 11,000 or 16,000 Winchester rifles from the 1860s.
Right.
That looked like they were fresh off the factory line.
Well, they're packed in gun grease.
A single shot, yeah. All these different conglomerations of weapons that trickled in. And
a
they were
single
shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, single shot. I mean, seriously, old hand-rolled brass cartridges.
But at least it was some weapons.
Right. But the problem with that is logistics.
And interchangeability.
You have 7mm Mauser weapons. You have old 11mm diameter black powder cartridges. You had a variety of different pistol cartridges that people are needing. And people would actually, like, take ammunition off of other people, especially off of the dead, because it's like, sorry, comrade, but I kind of need those last 5 bullets that you have in your pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Soviet support in big quotation marks there. A lot of the other artillery and aircraft that they supplied were also pretty dated by the time as well.
In other words, mostly useless.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the nationalist side had the latest in Italian and German weaponry.
Especially through the Condor Legion of Germany.
Yes, the Condor Legion was a Luftwaffe outfit that was basically loaned to the nationalists in Spain by Germany, by Hitler. And so, and they got to practice their dive bombing. Oh boy. And the famous painting by Pablo Picasso that I had the privilege of seeing.
The Guernica?
Guernica. Or how would that be pronounced more correctly?
That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've heard it that
Guernica.
Way.
Yeah.
It's a Basque name. But anyway, that was Pablo Picasso's home village. And he wasn't in Spain at the time that it got bombed, but it got carpet bombed by the Luftwaffe, wiped out, and he painted one of the most powerful anti-war images ever because of that. But suffice to say that conditions in the Republican zones were horrible. They were filthy. They were untrained. They had rotten food, and still they managed to prevail mostly. So more Americans started coming in over the Pyrenees Mountains, and he describes that trek, lots of hardship, and basically from lack of organization and interior fighting, and people assert that Joseph Stalin himself threw a monkey wrench into the works. So internecine, what should have been a united front, squabbling amongst socialists and anarchists, hard to believe, I know, but this internal division and the foreign aid that the nationalists were getting basically doomed the Spanish Revolution. So,
it
gets into good detail. Like I said, a history person would enjoy it and appreciate it. But it's easy to read like a novel, so it gets pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I recommend the book.
I definitely recommend it too. I'm still reading through it at the moment, but it is a pretty, like you said, it's a pretty fascinating account of the Spanish Civil War and the people that volunteered to fight in it, because I did a lot of follow-up work on researching the Abraham Lincoln Brigade specifically. That was part of the International Battalions of Volunteers. There still is a historical support group. The last Abraham Lincoln Brigade volunteer recently passed away. I think it was like in 2018.
Yeah.
He was like 100 and some odd years old.
Right.
He was also a big trade unionist and stuff like that. Aligned himself with the CPUSA for a long time after he came back from Spain. But he was a pretty fascinating character. And a lot of those people that fought in that war, some of them went on to fight on in the Second World War. And a lot of them were barred from officers' positions. And once they got back to the States, they were kept tabs on by the FBI because a lot of these international volunteers were aligned with leftist organizations, socialist, communist, and anarchist alike. So,
and you can follow that train all the way to Joseph McCarthy and the McCarthy trials.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it is a
they
pretty
fascinating... They were persecuted throughout the years is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
One caveat about the author's style... It can be kind of relentless. I read another book by him called King Leopold's Ghost about the horrific Belgian Congo goings-on at the time. And he can be relentless, and you can get a little bit burnt out on the graphic descriptions of violence and conditions on the battlefield. But stick with it, because you'll learn a lot.
Yeah.
So what I wanted to say in response to what you earlier mentioned, those people from the International Brigades, were known as premature anti-fascists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They knew what was going on, but they weren't supposed to do that.
Oh, yet. Antifa.
Yeah.
Thank you.
They were definitely some of the first people who recognized the danger of fascism. I mean, a lot of people in the 1920s and 30s recognized the early dangers. It's just a lot of people weren't quick to speak up about it because there were a lot of moneyed interests at the time defending it. Henry Ford. One of them. Texaco CEO sent millions of barrels of oil for the nationalists.
Lindbergh is another one.
Yeah. Lucky Lindy.
Yeah. It wasn't until we got in the Second World War that we finally did as a country recognize fascism as the threat that it was.
It wasn't a done deal right up until Pearl Harbor. And the American Nazi Bund, which was, you know, very active on the East Coast, they had a rally at Madison Square Garden. 20,000 people showed up to say Heil Hitler, you know, and they decked the place with pictures of George Washington and American patriotic regalia. But they were Nazis.
Yeah.
And what was his name in England? Oswald Mosley?
Yes.
Yeah, the British Union of Fascists. Yeah, fascism was on the rise, and it was not a done deal.
Yes, Lynn?
I don't know about the rest of you. I'd like to hear, but I never learned those things about Charles Lindbergh or Henry Ford. Mm-hmm. I only learned that they made cars and they're the first for the, you know,
you got the Chamber
line.
Of Commerce point of
view. Yeah, did you guys learn about that stuff? They were fascists and stuff?
Yeah, a long time ago.
A lot of prominent English people, too. A lot of rich industrialists and stuff like that praised Hitler because the fascist economic program appealed to the working class through a promise of economic recovery, but in reality, it just recovered the moneyed classes of society.
Right? I think, in answer to your question, sometimes it depended on where you grew up and you were in school.
Right.
I was in high school just outside of Washington, D.C., and I probably was in a privileged situation where we had some of the better teachers and the more liberal school boards, so we were getting more of an education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, unless I just didn't pay attention to a whole lot of years. But, I mean, and I was not at all, as I grew up, I was not a champion. But in my teens, I wanted to go down to Mississippi and march for the black people's rights. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to march for gay rights. And so I started in about, you know, like when I was close to 21. And then I was really involved, well, I marched. I was, you know, relatively involved in the anti-Vietnam War stuff. I know this will be edited out.
No, you're fine. You're fine. Speak loud.
And then after the war ended, I just dropped away, and I wasn't an advocate for anything, and I just like lived my own life and worked and.
And now look at you! Look at you here now.
and then I started when the war in Iraq started. My mom actually got me involved in listening to this guy on the radio that was you know, really radical for the time, totally against Bush and stuff. And so I started listening to this guy, and then there were other outlets where I was hearing stuff.
Who was that guy?
Mike Webb.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my mom actually said, you got to listen to him. He's against Bush, and he's right. My mom was like 75 or something like that. And she was urging me to get in, to have feeling about it, what was going on around me, and to pay attention. And since then, it's been, you know, a lot more.
So you're telling me hipness is genetic.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH. But yeah, no, I mean, I had an old neighbor like that too, actually, in the neighborhood that I grew up with. She was about 17 or 18 when she started getting involved with the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, and she's always been very much a hard swinger for progressive causes and stuff like that. She's still a rabble-rouser to this day, but yeah, I grew up right next to her, and she was definitely a big influence on my life when I was younger, and, you know, I still keep in touch with her. But yeah, she was very much the same way, kind of keeping involved with a lot of the social justice movements of the time as well. Yeah.
That's how you learn. I was hanging around with red diaper babies. That's
there
how
you
I
go.
Learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I learned a lot in the Young Workers Liberation League reading room, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I grew up in a pretty liberal upper middle class environment, and so we always had progressive views in the family and stuff like that, but I didn't really come this far to the IWW until after I graduated college. I mean, I'm pretty open about the fact that I used to be kind of like a very hard-swinging libertarian guy, you know, this contrarian streak that I had in my personality to deviate from my parents' politics. And, you know, once I actually started spending more time with working class people and their families and their friends and stuff like that, it was kind of like, oh crap, there's actually a bigger world than this very specific pro-capitalist, like, niche level of politics that I've decided to occupy. And it was a big readjustment for me over the course of, like, several years. And, you know, now I'm in the IWW, and I advocate for, you know, radical unionism and stuff like that. So it's definitely been a trend in the right direction for me.
Point being, you were open to change.
Yes.
And you learned some things, and that you couldn't just unlearn them.
Mm-hmm.
Al, how did you come by your politics?
He was dropped on his head as a boy.
Primarily from my father, who was a seminarian student in Frankfurt when Hitler came to power.
Whoa, seminarian.
So they were burning books. They were marching the street with torches. He knew there was going to be a war.
Mm-hmm.
He left Germany to return to Estonia, to take care of his mom during the war. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Estonia was in a unique position. The island of Saaremaa, the largest island in the Baltic Straits, is the whatever. Tallinn's the capital. It's the northern, so I hear, the northern ice-free port in Europe. So since the Napoleonic times, you know, they didn't have trains, you sailed your troops and your stuff up there. So it was valuable. There was a conflict between the Russians and the Germans about who would capture and keep this. And as the war ended, the Germans were retreating, and they took with them everything they wanted,
mm-hmm.
including people. My aunt Sophie and Ida were captured. My dad ran into the swamp and breathed through a hollow straw with rocks on his chest, while the women ran into the woods and rah, 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 with the dogs, and they were captured, shipped to Hamburg, where they were then put in cattle cars and shipped to Nuremberg for
mm-hmm.
farm labor.
So you came by this through family history and stories.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Sophie went to Australia. She was a refugee, went to Australia. Ida stayed and got to the United States and stayed. And what did she tell me? Well,
and I came by it growing up in just outside of Washington, D.C. in the 50s. number one, being Jewish, I was very well aware of the restrictive redlining and discrimination that Jews experienced. And then coming into the 60s, I became aware of what was going on for people of color in the South and all over the United States. My mother hired housekeepers, quote-unquote maids because she was middle class. And the workers that she brought in would let me know a little bit about what was going on for them. I ended up going to my first college in North Carolina, where my eyes were really opened up. And I had a house mother who said to me, "Oh, you're Jewish. I thought you were white," meaning I was in the wrong dormitory. Okay. So I had a number of experiences that way. And slowly I just began to wake up and realize that justice is important, and justice means everybody. And I've kind of been on that path ever since.
So I'd like to finish up what I was going to say.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. No, it's quite right, except that Ida, who's my aunt, who came out of the labor camps, told me that her sister, Sophie, was ill, and you had to make a quota of gathering fruits and vegetables or whatever, you know, leaning, I guess, yeah. So Ida did that. She pulled two quotas so that Sophie got fed, and she would be stealing potatoes and carrots and putting them in her pockets to make soup in the dorms, yeah. And Ida said, "They put so much sawdust in the bread, it made your gums creep to eat it."
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, but the rest of my education, I mean, I got this, my father was a pacifist because of that. And then when I was in high school, in the late 60s, I met Will Slayton, fellow worker Will Slayton, who was a Wobbly way back then, and a Stalinist Wob, which is really weird. We argued about stuff, but I took care of him. Rick Beck also helped for the last couple of years of Will's life, so that's where I got my introduction, and because of Will, I did Joyce Kornbluh's Rebel Voices. I recommend that book. You want a history of the IWW? That's the one to read if you're going to read one of them. The first point I wanted to make was that fellow worker DJ Alperovitz, Alperovitz, as you say, is sort of the union's archivist now. He has been keeping track of members of the IWW who served with the International Brigades. If you want a list, he's got a partial one, yeah.
That's good, because he doesn't, Hochschild doesn't, he mentions only in passing IWW. You know, he would say radicals like the IWW or something, but he didn't get into specifics about how many, because Wobblies also went down to Mexico. That was Vincent St. John, and rumored to be Joe Hill, went down there to fight in the Mexican Revolution.
That's so right. Carlos Cortez's father came from there. He went down Norte when the revolution failed, yeah.
Yeah,
and that Miguel would be interested in that because he's expressed an interest in the Maganistas.
Well, he picked up a book, and I've got one too, at the Anarchist Book Fair, called Bad Mexicans. It's about the revolutionary Mexicans. Yeah. If that's a little daunting to you, I would suggest one of my favorites is Homage to Catalonia by George Orwell.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I learned several things. Well, Orwell said that when he was in Barcelona, it was the first time he'd ever seen the working class on the saddle. There's another line when he's in a village and looking for food, and a man working in a restaurant said, "If you were John D. Rockefeller, you could not buy a bowl of soup in this town unless we gave it to you." Well, here, my favorite, I'm gonna end this with my favorite story is, at the end of the Second World War, the fascists, there was Mussolini, of course, and there was Hitler. And yes, there was Franco, but the Spanish were not actually involved in combat.
Right.
They were just taking care of the anarchists and the socialists and the communists at home. The war is over, and Eisenhower was commander-in-chief of the Western troops.
Right.
European troops. So he's on a tour, and he's coming into Madrid to visit Franco. One of Franco's aide-de-camps, whatever you call it, said, "Generalissimo, tomorrow Eisenhower will be here. Can I suggest we take the paintings down? Of Adolf Hitler and Mussolini, we should take them down and put them away until at least until Eisenhower is here, and then when he leaves, we can put it back up if you want." But
yeah, Franco what did pictures? Escape any kind of
accountability
or punishment. He died peacefully in his sleep in 75. He set it up. He set up the Spanish government at the time to technically go back to a monarchy, but the person who was. I think it was Juan Carlos, I think the monarch's
name was. I visited Spain, and it was still under Franco.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd love to hear about that sometime. But basically, Franco set up the government so that this monarchist guy could take over and become king. And the second this person becomes king, he goes, I'm reversing everything that Franco did. He completely went on his own regard and just said, all of the Francoist laws that were put into place need to be repealed. We need to transition to democracy, even if it technically takes any constitutional rights that I have under this new constitution that Franco made. I'm out. Like, this. There needs to be some accountability. If we can't try a dead man, at the very least, we can change the country.
Really? I think this is an interesting opportunity to segue a little bit to what is happening with Israel and Palestine. Mm-hmm. Because we are seeing a horrific thing play out in front of us. Mm-hmm. That could very well result in the world war again. And I know that the listener is pretty well aware of what's happening in Israel and Gaza. And is pretty well aware that the United States is very divided in what they should be doing in response or not responding to what is happening. But first of all, I want to just, listener, in case you've been living in an absolute silo or in
A cave.
On October 7th, Hamas launched a horrible raid, I'm going to call it raid attack, on Israelis and killed over 1,000 people. And the Israeli government and military were completely embarrassed that they had not been aware that it was coming and that it took them by surprise. Hamas took over 150 hostages in its wake as they withdrew. That's in addition to the 1,000 that they killed. And Israel was left very shaken up and embarrassed. In response, the political people in Israel scrambled to outdo each other in being, quote, tough on crime. I mean, there's no... I can't justify what Hamas did, but what Israel did in response is so shameful and so horrific, in my opinion. And I am Jewish, but I can distinguish between my religion and the Israeli state. And that is something very important to do. So where we're at now is we have the pro-Israel state lobby, such as AIPAC, and some other DC lobbyists who scream that any criticism of what the state of Israel is doing to the Palestinians is anti-Semitic talk. And then we have the other faction that is saying, from the mountains to the sea, Palestine will be free, which happens to also be a pretty inflammatory statement historically, to people from Israel, because when Israel was first established and the first 1948 boundaries were established, some of the Middle Eastern countries and Palestinians used that same slogan.
Wasn't the slogan from the river?
From the river to the sea.
Yeah.
Palestine will be free. Used that same slogan as a war cry to wipe Israel off the face of the map. So we have a fairly complex situation here, none of which absolves the state of Israel from going into Gaza and wiping out over 500,000 people so far, creating these areas where they say, oh, get out of this part of Palestine, go to the south. And then when people try to go to the south, they bomb the south, where they tell people that they need to get out, but they can't get out, where they indiscriminately bomb innocent civilians and children, for God's sake. So we are looking at a situation in which, from my eyes, it looks to me like Israel is trying to draw the United States into this situation where now, what are we doing? We're bombing Syria? What is going on here? It's widening. It's getting worse. And militarily, this cannot win. It's been going on for over 50 years, and a military solution is no solution. So we have basically the state of Israel becoming an untenable fascistic state. And the United States is still supporting them and not listening to the growing rise of horror and protest in its own citizens. We have people gathering by the hundreds of thousands and saying, more than just a ceasefire now, this has got to stop. We could stop sending our weapons to Israel. They don't need them. We can call our elected officials. Can't hurt. People are around the world rising up. On the other hand, we're getting huge backlash. We're getting the first black professor, or is it dean?
President.
President, thank you, of Harvard was completely...
pilloried.
Thank you, that's the word I'm looking for. By the pro-Israel state group, they accused her of being anti-Semitic, and she's getting death threats. And she finally was forced to step down. Anyhow, there's horrible things happening with the academic community once again, with limits on freedom of speech and free inquiry and
academic freedom.
Academic freedom, which kind of brings us full circle, which is why I said something about the education system. Yeah. I was talking about it on that kind of level rather than...
And I understood that, actually. Yeah. I just felt defensive.
So, in reference to your book about the Spanish Civil War and the Nationalists and the Republicans, and in looking at what's happening now in the United States and in the world, frankly, with on one hand the rise of autocratic leaders and governments that have absolutely no interest in upholding the UN treaties that were established to supposedly ensure safety after things like the rise of Nazis in Germany, and of course we've seen things ever since then. Never Again has become a laughingstock because we've got Cambodia, we've got Rwanda, we've got Kosovo, we've had all of these things after, and now we have Israel, and we've got the United States once again supporting.
Banking it.
And here's this book that you just read and reported on, Spain in Our Hearts. So I want to open this up for discussion. What do we do? Where do we go from here?
Well, from the organized labor perspective, there has been a growing, not just a labor movement, but a labor movement specifically to call for Israel to end its invasion of the Gaza Strip, to recall its military forces, and to be held accountable for allegations of genocide that the Israelis have been perpetrating against the Palestinians in that area, as well as in the West Bank. A lot of these organized labor movements, including the organized labor movement within the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because there are union organizations in those areas, have been doing some pretty effective solidarity and protest work around the world to try and coerce world governments into essentially calling off the dogs, so to speak, and letting Gazan citizens move back into what's left of their homes and to repatriate them. So, yeah. There's that aspect. I think on another hand, and I also want to report recent news about this as well, very briefly. South Africa just launched...
I saw that.
...an international legal case, South Africa v. Israel, at the Genocide Convention at the International Court of Justice. South Africa is alleging that Israel is, quote, committing genocide in manifest violation of the Genocide Convention, and South Africa asked the ICJ to issue provisional measures ordering Israel to halt its military campaign. So,
and South Africa should know, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I find that a little bit ironic that South Africa most recently got rid of apartheid, and they're the ones calling them out.
Yeah,
a little bit of irony is a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's great.
I mean, just to focus on United States politics as well, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this issue plays out in terms of the election, because it's 2024, it's an election year. Joe Biden has been very unapologetic about supporting Israel, specifically through military aid.
Oh, that's a whole nother can of worms. We're a deep doo-doo.
I know. This whole situation is a can of worms. Like you said, this history goes back to arguably even earlier than 1948 in the Balfour Declaration.
Mm-hmm. Right. It goes back to Herschel and the original Zionist settlers.
Yeah. I mean, the current...
And I was raised on Zionism. It took me a lot to take the blinders off my eyes.
Mm-hmm. I think that in terms of solutions of what to do, the labor movement is striking or acting against it. There's been huge international solidarity asking for Israel to stop invading Gaza, to stop bombing civilians. South Africa is currently attempting to take them to court for genocide and other war crimes. I think that this, like you said, this will not play out in Israel's favor. But what's happening in Israel politically is that there is this very right-wing government that is currently altering the constitution, that is currently currently influencing the Supreme Court as well to kind of go along with its particular set of politics. And even within Israel, even within the Zionist camp, the current government that is currently committing the genocide in Gaza isn't terribly popular either. Mm-hmm. I mean, they killed their own Israeli civilians that they were trying to rescue from Hamas.
Right.
Yeah.
And I want to remind the listener that one reason why we're focusing on this in WAB radio, actually two reasons. Number one, people that are in the military, the soldiers, are workers, and we need to protect workers' rights. And number two, our climate is going down the tubes, and what are we doing? Promoting blowing things up.
Yes.
You're going to continue to hear about it in WAB radio.
Yeah.
Get ready.
And I think, especially on the note of workers' rights as well, a lot of Jewish labor organizations, pro-Palestinian labor organizations and the pro-Palestinian movement within the AFL-CIO and especially in the IWW, the aspect of workers' rights doesn't just extend to members of the military, it also hugely expands upon the civilian population as well. There can't be organized labor in a country that is no longer standing.
I have to tell you on a personal note, and this is way before this latest genocide, when I started hearing of the Israeli army plowing under 1,000-year-old olive trees,
mm-hmm.
I just cried.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even a person. But what's happening here is insanity. And I can't support insanity.
Yeah.
So on a slightly what the hell can I do about it note, I want to tell the listener about two things that are coming up.
And just to remind the listener, we do have an official Facebook page for the radio show, just WAB Radio. We do try to update our fellow listeners and followers on there as to local upcoming events for how they can get involved, whether that's labor activism, whether that's picket lines that are currently taking place, social justice issues like this. We try to keep our listeners as involved and informed as possible.
And also, listener, if you can't make it to that, you can certainly call Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray and urge them to vote no on any further military aid to Israel. So that's another thing that you can do right now, and you could call them every day. You could make yourself a real pain in the patoot for them. That would be a very good idea. They need to know. Thank you.
I would also like to remind our listeners that there's another local upcoming event, and this will also be jointly hosted with the Industrial Workers of the World here in the South Puget Sound area. There is a prison rights movie night and town hall that's going to be at Evergreen Tacoma at 2 p.m. And this is going to be talking specifically about the ongoing prison rights movement. Do you have any more details on that, fellow worker Marilyn?
It's Saturday, January 27th, starting at 2. It will be a town hall. We have several speakers lined up. Plus, we will be showing Dr. Gilda Shepherd's award-winning documentary, Been Down So Long, which is a hyper-local look at the school-to-prison pipeline in Pierce County and in Tacoma.
Mm.
And I've seen it. It's amazing. So it's a free event. Of course, we'll accept donations if people want to help out. The jailhouse lawyers speak, and incarcerated individuals that are fighting for prisoner rights. and we have been contacted by them. We have a subcommittee called Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, and we were contacted by them with a plea for getting the word out about their issues and to help them. So that's Saturday, January 27th, 2 o'clock at Evergreen State College, Tacoma on 6th Avenue. And it's free, and there's parking. And come find out what it's all about and learn more. Thank you.
Thank you.
So before we wrap this up, I want to go back to the Israel, Palestine, and American labor issue, just briefly. Trumka was the head of the AFL-CIA, and he's dead.
So CIO, why?
I said CIA, and I meant it. The position is now currently held by a woman named Liz Shuler, the first woman to be head of the AFL-CIO. And the story is confusing to me because it's come from two different sources. One said that the Martin Luther King County Central Labor Council in Seattle passed a resolution that said labor in King County says ceasefire. Now, one story. The other story is the same thing, except it only happened in Olympia with the Thurston Mason Lewis County Central Labor Council. They said the same thing. I haven't tracked down which of these is real, but two different sources said two different groups pledged their support for a ceasefire. Ms. Shuler, who is now head of the AFL, said, you will not do that without my permission. I'm the boss. You're not. I'm in control. You're not. And the AFL will take no positions without my prior approval.
Lewis County. Your point being that unions are supposed to be relatively democratic, correct?
Apparently. We thought so.
They're supposed to be allowed to vote on things?
No. Nonsense.
And this person seems to think that it's for her particular mouthpiece, a megaphone. And if it's not her voice, then it doesn't have a voice?
She said that without her permission, her consent, because she's the boss at the top of the pyramid, and there's a committee of lackeys that work with her, they will make policy, not the membership.
She may be on her way out.
She just got there.
She may be on her way out anyhow.
You're an optimist. We'll see.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Just to close out the show, we hope that we have kept our listeners well informed as to ongoing labor organizing and activism. Of course, our show broadcasts out of multiple different broadcasters, specifically 101.9 Radio Tacoma, 95.3 KTQA, and 94.9 KZAX up in Bellingham. And we thank our Bellingham listeners for tuning in.
We have to wish everybody a Happy New Year.
Yes, we wish all of our fellow workers out there a Happy New Year. And we hope that whatever organizing, agitating, inoculating, organizing and unionizing that you do, that you have the full strength of your workers, and we hope that you get the wins that the working class deserves in the new year of 2024. We thank you so much for tuning in to listen. Once again, this was WOB Radio from the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. Solidarity.
Solidarity. Solidarity. Solidarity.